The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'm going to briefly set the stage by summarizing how we got to where we are today with our system for determining whether captured individuals in the war on terror should be detained as enemy combatants. The starting point, I think this was mentioned this morning, was the Supreme Court's Hamdi decision in 2003, which held that while the president does have authority to detain individuals captured in the war against Al-Qaeda and others authorized by Congress after 9/11, at least those captured on the battlefield, including U.S. citizens, the government must, at least if they're U.S. citizens, under the Due Process Clause, provide that the detainees be given a reasonable opportunity to challenge the determination that they are enemy combatants, to challenge that determination before a neutral decision maker. Shortly thereafter, the Defense Department established the CSRT system, the Combatant Status Review Tribunal system, with procedures that I think were designed to try to satisfy the minimum requirements of the Hamdi case, and you can argue about whether they do or not. You certainly can argue, as we'll hear today, about whether they're adequate or not. And then finally, in the Detainee Treatment Act in 2005, after the Razul decision, the Congress, while ending jurisdiction or trying to end jurisdiction in the federal courts for habeas actions filed by the Guantanamo detainees, did sort of ratify the CSRT system and establish limited judicial review of CSRT decisions in the Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. As the years have gone by, it's become increasingly clear that what we have here at Guantanamo is not a normal wartime detention system. The detention may be long or even indefinite. And while some detainees have and will be released, some will neither be subjected to military trials or released anytime soon, although I was interested to hear from Mr. Bellinger this morning that the administration is considering doing something about eternal detention. So this leads to the following questions for our panel, and I'm going to ask each of them in turn to address those questions. First, do we have a de facto preventive detention system? And if so, is the current CSRT system with the limited judicial review in the D.C. Circuit adequate to assure either the accuracy or the fairness of those detention decisions? If not, should we have some kind of new national security court to make the initial detention decisions in lieu of the CSRTs, or to review them instead of the D.C. Circuit? And if so, what should this new kind of court look like? I'll quickly introduce our panelists. You have biographies, I think. It's a wonderful panel, and they're seated in the order I'm going to call on them to speak. The first speaker will be Matt Waxman, who is a brand new professor at Columbia Law School. After having served in several very important positions in the Bush administration in the War on Terror, sort of bouncing back and forth between Condoleezza Rice and Don Rumsfeld, he was the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Detention Matters at the Defense Department, and then went over to be the Deputy Director of the Policy Office at the State Department. To his right is, to the right of the novice law professor is an old law professor, a youthful old law professor, David Cole, who most of you know from Georgetown University Law Center. David is not only a distinguished law professor and writer, but he is that rarity, a successful litigating law professor who and who established his credentials as a litigator in terrorist civil liberties cases long before 9/11. And he was a troublemaker for the Clinton administration and has continued to be a troublemaker for the Bush administration. To his right is another one of our crop of young law professors, Robert Chesney from Wake Forest Law School, known to many of you as Bobby Chesney, who is one of the bright young stars in the national security law field and the operator of probably the best national security law internet service in history. And finally, if you've gotten your fill of professors, we have Elisa Massimino, who many of you know is the director of the Washington Office of Human Rights Watch. No, I always get them mixed up. Human Rights First. I wish you hadn't changed your name from the Lawyers Committee for Human Rights, which I grew up knowing you as. But Elisa is one of the leading figures in the ongoing debates in Congress and in the public at large on the issues relating to the treatment and detention of detainees at Guantanamo. Okay, with that as an introduction, I'm going to ask the panelists to keep their remarks to 5 to 7 minutes, and we'll have some time for questions. Matt, why don't you go first?
Great. So let me begin with some general descriptive points and then talk a little bit about the future and at least pose some what I think are some important questions. My first point is I would answer in the affirmative the question about whether we have a de facto detention regime or is this not coming through? Is that any better? Is that better? No, I'm getting some yeses and some noes. Yeah? Okay. We'll go with that. So I think we do have a de facto administrative detention or preventive detention regime right now at Guantanamo and elsewhere, and I'll explain in a little more detail in a moment. I think this is a process that's significantly improved over the last few years, but it has some huge problems. I think it is prone to inaccuracies, and I think it is not a system that has the type of legitimacy at home or abroad that's necessary to sustain it and really fulfill important policy objectives. My second point then would be that I think where one comes out in the debate about whether or not we need some sort of comprehensive administrative detention legislation depends on one's starting point. If one thinks about this question in the abstract with a clean slate and about the merits and demerits of a system, that may produce one result. If, on the other hand, you consider that we have some significant problems with our current system and that new legislation offers a possible way out of a hole that we've dug, I think that may produce a very different outcome. The third general point I just make is to emphasize what I think are huge risks on both sides of this debate. So I think that I come at this from the perspective that the terrorism threat is very real and that our failure to detain broadly enough carries major risks. On the other hand, I think creating any new detention system has huge risks too, and not just risks to sort of the liberty side of the liberty security balance, but as David Cole argues very well, I think any new detention regime, also especially a broad one, carries security risks too. That detention is not always is sometimes an ineffective tool. It can radicalize, it can alienate, and it can undermine cooperation with our coalition partners. My fourth general point is that I think the incremental reform that we've seen, at least at Guantanamo, as a product of litigation, has been a very poor process of reform. I think the Supreme Court and lower courts have done some good things in improving the processes at Guantanamo, but no court is able through litigation to take a comprehensive look at what I think from a policy standpoint the rules of detention should be going forward. And I think that this sort of accumulation of Guantanamo-specific rules that we now have as a result of Guantanamo-specific legislation is dangerous. Because, you know, Dan began today by saying that we, in a sense, have three regimes of detention now. We have the normal Article III criminal process, we have military commissions, and we have CSRTs. I think that's an incomplete list. In addition to those, we have a different legal regime or procedural regime that applies in Bagram, Afghanistan. We have, the President has disclosed, a CIA program for detention and interrogation that presumably operates through different rules. We have a system by which we might detain somebody and transfer him or her to another country. And those are just the rules or systems for detention, as we saw reportedly in a case just a day or two ago involving an Al-Qaeda deputy. The U.S. government, in addition to capturing and detaining people, in some cases kills people. And one danger of taking a small slice of this overall problem
to put it bluntly, the more you regulate Guantanamo, specifically without tackling the broader problem of what are you going to do with a broader set of individuals whom the government needs to take some action against, the more you may create an incentive for the government to use alternative systems that may be worse, that may be less humane, that may be less effective in terms of counterterrorism. So, with that as background, let me just sort of pose some questions. I'm not yet convinced of the need for a new administrative detention regime, though I am certainly open to it. And I think my openness stems from a concern that the status quo is just not sustainable. And comprehensive legislation offers one possible solution to the problems that we see in the status quo. I'm troubled that the focus of discussion at that point centers overwhelmingly on procedural issues, and I think there's sort of an emerging consensus as to the minimum procedural safeguards that any new detention system should have. And just to name them quickly, I think there's sort of an emerging consensus that any new statute should at least include judicial review, adversarial process, whereby individuals are represented by counsel, and some degree of transparency. And beyond that, there are a lot of specific details. Should it be the FISA court? Should it be a special panel of federal judges? Should it be regular generalist Article III judges? Should you have a special detainee bar? And those issues are important, but at least there's sort of some general consensus on some basic minimum elements of any new system. Let me just say, though, that I think it's a mistake to focus exclusively or even too heavily on those procedural issues. That I think there are a number of important substantive questions, definitional questions, that are equally, if not more important, to getting right this sort of balance of security and liberty. And among them are, what would be the purpose of administrative detention? Is this fundamentally about incapacitating threats? Is it about disrupting specific plots? Is it about gaining intelligence? The way one answers those questions will tell you a lot about what an administrative detention system should look like.
Then there's the question of whom and how do we define substantively the class of individuals who would be subject to detention. There's a temporal issue, the duration of detention. Is this short versus long-term detention? Is it something that would be reviewed periodically? And let me just conclude by saying, by emphasizing again, I think these types of substantive questions beyond those, beyond just answering the procedural questions are important to getting the strategic and policy balance right. That I think even if you have perfect procedures, if you can't answer effectively and precisely these types of substantive questions, then I think you're not going to end up with a good statute. So I hope that in the discussion that follows, we might focus not just on some of the procedural questions that came up earlier, but also some of these difficult substantive questions.
Thank you, Matt. That was very good. 7.2 minutes. David?
The main lesson I learned from this morning was that AU has a special definition of 5 minutes. I'll try to stick to Matt's tremendous precedent. I also want to say that I think that Judge Brinkema's really remarkable lunchtime discussion has made the rest of this conference essentially academic. But of course, most of us are academics, so that doesn't stop us from talking. Nothing stops us from talking, including time limits, apparently. To spend a second responding to Dan's questions and then turning to what I want to talk about, I think we have preventive detention in this country. We have had it for a long time. We have it in a variety of regimes. We have it under the laws of war. We have it in the criminal context with the Bail Reform Act. We have it in the immigration context. 5,000 foreign nationals were preventively detained in the United States in anti-terrorism measures after 9/11. We have preventive detention. So the question is not whether we ought to have it or whether we should not have it. We have it. In fact, every democracy has some form of preventive detention. Really, the question is how we ought to go about regulating it. I think we have a broken preventive detention scheme that needs to be fixed in a variety of ways, starting with restricting the, abusive exploitation of laws that were not designed as preventive detention laws for those purposes, as we saw after 9/11 with the detention of foreign nationals. But I want to address the central question that I think the initial panel raised, which is whether we ought to create a third way, this sort of national security court as a third way. And in general, I'm suspicious of third-way approaches. They always sound really reasonable. You know, the traditional argument is, well, there are these people who say these extreme things, and then there's these people who say these extreme things, and I'm in the middle, so I must be right. I don't think that's always the case. Here, that comes forward in the notion that there's the criminal model on one side, there's the war model on the other side, and shouldn't we, in this new paradigm, come up with some third way that is somehow in between the criminal model and the war model? And national security courts, I think, are a part of that approach. This is the idea is this is a different kind of war, so the war model doesn't quite work. This is a different kind of crime, so the criminal model doesn't quite work. And maybe we'd do better to, rather than to try to, you know, jiggle with those forms, to create an institution that recognizes that this threat falls somewhere in between. I think there are good reasons to adhere to the two separate models and to resist creating a hybrid in the middle. The two separate models, I think, serve us well and give the government the authority, the power, the resources to protect us from the threat that is out there. The criminal model is a due process model. It's about justice. It's about holding people accountable for what they have done. It presumes innocence. It gives rights of confrontation. It requires proof of wrongdoing beyond a reasonable doubt, because we want to do justice, and we only want to hold people who have done something wrong, provably wrong. It's applicable to the most heinous of crimes, whether mass murderers or terrorists, and it has been adequate throughout our history to deal with mass murderers, to deal with terrorists, as Judge Brinkema so eloquently attested, to deal with spies involving a tremendous national security information and challenges and the like. The war model, on the other side, is quite different. It emphasizes not justice, but force, the use of military force against those who have attacked us or pose an imminent threat of attack. The war model, because it's predicated on force, not justice, makes huge concessions in terms of due process. Extrajudicial killing is okay. Collateral damage to civilians, as long as it's proportional, is okay. Long-term preventive detention with minimal process, an Article 5 hearing is very minimal process, is okay. But it is presumptively an exceptional state of affairs, not the norm. Criminal justice is the norm. War is the exception. Both, I believe, both of these approaches are legitimate ways to respond to terrorism depending on the circumstances. It is not an either-or. I don't think the question is, well, you know, should we just respond to terrorism with the criminal model, or should we just respond to it through military? I think a government has the option of choosing one or the other depending upon the circumstances. But they are very different models at bottom, and I think it's dangerous for us to create a hybrid in the middle that loses some of those distinctions. And I think a great example of the danger is, you know, what in some sense prompted this whole discussion, my colleague Neil Katyal and Jack Goldsmith's op-ed in the New York Times, which calls for national security courts not to determine the status of al-Qaeda fighters against us in this particular conflict, but to create a freestanding, at least as I read it, and it's only an op-ed, so but as they set forth, to create a freestanding authority to subject suspected terrorists to long-term preventive detention. So they have essentially taken this war model in which, yes, you can hold the enemy for the duration of the conflict, and said, we're going to extend it, take it out of its exceptional circumstances, and apply it to this category we call suspected terrorists with no necessary connection to any particular military conflict that we're involved in. And, of course, some acts of terror justify or warrant a military response. There's been one, right, in our history that triggered a military response, and I think it was an appropriate or military response, the initial military response, that is, to close down the camps in Afghanistan and the like. But we've had many, many terrorist attacks in this country, and all the rest of them did not trigger a military response, triggered a criminal justice response. And I think to mix the two is I think, very, 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 very dangerous. And many other countries, of course, have been subject to many more terrorist attacks than we've been subject to and have dealt with it through the criminal justice system. So I agree with those who say that we can hold those who are fighting against us for the duration of the conflict. I agree with John Bellinger that you can't take the position that simply because this might be a long-term, will be a long-term battle, that somehow you have to release them ab initio. I do think we need to have fairer procedures to make sure that we're holding the right people, and that's, I think, will be worked out as we go forward. But I think we ought to resist this temptation to say, well, there's war and there's criminal justice and then there's terrorism somewhere in the middle. It doesn't always make sense to adopt a hybrid, because sometimes you lose what is valuable about each side of the continuum. And I think it's especially dangerous where it is important to to draw clear lines. And it seems to me that one of the clearest lines, or one of the most important lines, is the line between war and peace, between force and justice. And I worry that creating a kind of hybrid will normalize the exception and will do damage to the principle of justice. Thank you.
I got nervous when David said that a third way proposal, he's suspicious of them, he's suspicious of the hybrid approach, because that's my whole shtick in academia, is to try to isolate the people I disagree with out on the margins and portray myself as the reasonable middle. So not for a performance of that very shtick. I'd like to use my time to advance a series of propositions about detention policy reform, and a lot of this will echo really elements of both what David and Matt said. I think all too often there's a tendency to assume that when people don't agree in this area that there's actually widespread disagreement, when in fact when we drill down there's often actually quite a bit of things we all agree on. Steve and I have had endless times at conferences to talk about these sorts of things, and even though we start off assuming that we're sort of far apart, we often find that what separates is very minimal, and that minimal and yet it is true. See? And often that gap between us, or the gulf between us, what I think is can be described in what Jack and I, in this forthcoming paper that's in y'all's packets, I hope everyone takes a look at it, describe as basically something that can be bridged for the most part with reasonable policy choices if only the legislature will actually get involved in detention policy, which is sort of the, if I say one thing you remember, I hope it's that we can all agree that there really is a role for Congress here, and maybe the executive branch doesn't want Congress to play that role. Maybe Congress doesn't want to play that role. It's understandable politically why both those things may be true. They still need to do it. So my five propositions, or the multiple propositions, begin with this one. One size does not fit all when it comes to detention policy, and by this I mean that a reasonably and well-calibrated detention system is actually not going to be one single detention framework for these types of problems. It's going to be at least two. For me, this follows from the premise that the risk of erroneous detentions and the cost of having a heightened process are going to vary depending on the circumstances in which someone's captured. And this came out in the remarks this morning when folks talked about the difference between combat zone captures, or captures that take place in a traditional combat setting, particularly captures affected by U.S. soldiers in what anyone would recognize as combat, contrasting that with, let's call it, the Boumediene scenario, the civilian setting capture, where either our people, our operators, or maybe the operators of another cooperating intelligence agency from a foreign country roll someone up in a snatch situation. There are dramatic differences, and I don't think, when most of us are talking about the need to ramp up process and increase legitimacy and change the status quo from what may be going on with the CSERTs and the other elements of the current system, I hope that we're talking about changing things for the latter scenario, the civilian capture scenario, and we're not talking about something that's going to affect the people. I mean, right now as we speak, it's nighttime in Afghanistan and Iraq, at least I think it is, and chances are there are U.S. soldiers who are engaged somewhere in either of those countries. There are U.S. soldiers who are engaged in a firefight as we speak. They're going to kill some people. Some of the people they don't kill may be captured, and I don't think we have the same risk of erroneous detention or the same ability to withstand heightened process for the people that are captured in that setting. So I want to try to cabin that off. Second proposition. The second proposition it speaks to this question of that we heard about at lunch. Maybe we could just have a criminal justice approach. At a minimum, I would say we certainly should only be asking that question as to the non-combat captures. I don't think we should be talking about going to a pure criminal prosecution approach for combat scenario captures. I don't think that's what people mean for the most part, and I don't think we should be considering that. Should we consider it for the non-combat capture scenario? We should certainly consider it. In fact, I would begin by saying that when it comes to captures within the United States, it should certainly be the primary, if not the exclusive option within the United States. It should be the very exceptional circumstance within the U.S. when we talk about capturing someone and indulging in other than criminal, or, I think David would be quick to emphasize, we also have a major piece here that's immigration law, and most of us are not as competent to talk about it as David, so I won't, but using more traditional non-military or non-administrative detention means. But setting that aside, There are captors, of course, outside the United States that are non-combat captors. What about that scenario? Could we, should we have criminal prosecution only there? As Judge Brinkman said, the system is more robust than its critics give it credit for. It is, in fact, able to do quite a bit, and we might be able to do it. But Judge Brinkman also said it's a separate question whether we should, as a matter of policy, whether there might be policy reasons to avoid it. And I want to offer, we could talk a little bit about the practical difficulties, but I think we talked about that at lunch enough, and I'm not going to try to second-guess anything that a judge who supervised those trials has said. I want to instead focus on separate policy considerations, what I would describe as the infection concern. This is an argument to the effect that the pressure to act preventively, not reactively, but preventively in terrorism scenarios or suspected terrorism scenarios, places tremendous pressure on the government to intervene prospectively rather than ex post. What happens in the criminal justice system as that pressure mounts? Well, you could have pressure expressed either through procedural change or substantive detention criteria change. In the criminal justice system, because of the constitutionalization of most of our procedural safeguards, there's really no room for the balloon to be squeezed or to grow in that direction. And so what do you see? What should you expect to see? You should expect to see, and you will see if you look closely enough, expansion of substantive detention criteria in the direction of being able to intervene before conduct occurs. Now, that, of course, runs a little contrary to the tradition of our substantive criminal laws, which, in general, focus on acts and conduct. What we've seen well before 9/11, to emphasize this, well before 9/11, but especially afterwards, is an expansion of what you can call inchoate crime concepts, but concepts that border on membership liability through creative interpretations of the material support law. And then more recently, this is something I didn't catch on to at first. I thought it was all about the material support laws, and I realized, especially through the Padilla prosecution, it's really also about the expansion of conspiracy, which, as we all know, is already a pretty broad concept. It's much broader now, and I'd love to talk in the comments if anyone wants to or afterwards about what exactly was really charged against Jose Padilla. It's very interesting, and it's a warning shot about whether we should be complacent about adopting a purely criminal justice approach, at least doing it in a way that could then spill over into other parts of the system as well. And we all know that when you create a substantive criminal law regime such as RICO to deal with a particular type of exacerbated criminal law problem, it could spread beyond its original focus. So another proposition, having said that, to suggest that perhaps criminal justice is not, in fact, and should not be our only tool here, I want to be really clear in my third proposition. The CSIRT system, I don't think, is sustainable. Let's assume for the sake of argument that it's lawful, that it satisfies whatever constitutional, statutory, international standards might apply here. I know that's hotly contested, but let's just assume that it's lawful. Be that as it may, there's ample reason to believe that it's not sustainable over the long term domestically, internationally, any number of reasons that we're all pretty familiar with. From a human rights perspective or a security perspective, I think both perspectives are beginning to coalesce around a consensus that some form of increased legitimacy is necessary for the system. That means reform. So, fourth proposition, what could this reform look like? Well, there are actually two questions. What are you going to do with process, and what are you going to do with substantive detention criteria? You cannot look at these in isolation. They're a system, as Ben has put it. They're a system. They relate to one another. It's dynamic. If you squeeze one without paying attention to the other, it's like squeezing a balloon. If you ramp up process without worrying about the substantive detention criteria, you may not accomplish much because the detention criteria may be quite broad, and it works in reverse, of course. So let me say just a few things quickly about process. There needs to be a sea change in perceptions of legitimacy for any kind of system that's going to evolve as a successor to this combination of DTA review, ARBs, CSIRT, and I might add, in-theater screening. We were talking earlier, the suggestion was made that since we're not doing Article 5s in some settings, there's no in-theater screening. But of course there is in-theater screening. It's not asking whether anyone gets POW status, but it is screening. So there is something going on. There are many stages to the process. But it's got to change, and it should change at the long-term detention decision-making stage, which is currently the CSIRT stage. The linchpin of change, in my view, should be appointment of counsel. There needs to be counsel that introduces adversariality. That helps to remediate a lot of the other problems. It will help. It won't solve how we deal with coerced information statements from other detainees, but it will help rebut or poke holes in the weaknesses of that sort of evidence. It will address, to some extent, the problem of ex parte evidence and the use of classified information. At a minimum, there ought to be at least the counsel in there, and so on and so forth. Other things that probably need to change. And it's important here to realize that the judge is already in the process. The horses are out of the barn in terms of whether or not judges are going to have a significant role. Given that they are clearly going to have a significant role, if only through the DTA review, if not through habeas as well, I think at this point it makes a lot of sense to have the judge in there at the initial stage to add legitimacy and credibility and enhanced accuracy to the review process. Lastly, substantive grounds for detention. This is a conference in and of itself, and even if we had the whole day to talk about it, I don't know how far we would get. Let me say this. It's devilishly hard to specify exactly what detention criteria ought to be. A lot of the briefing in Boumediene talks about maybe we can import the direct participation in hostility standard from the targeting law of the Usin Bello. That's certainly not what the direct participation standard is meant to achieve. It's supposed to define who you can target. But it does lead to interesting arguments about when someone who nominally may be a civilian from the perspective of the law of war may nonetheless be a target for military force. There are interesting debates about perhaps saying at least we can find consensus on the leadership cadre, that if we can begin by agreeing that Osama bin Laden could be detained, how much consensus do we lose as we move through the tiers of relationship out from the leadership cadre to persons who self-confessedly consider themselves al-Qaeda operatives, subject to the group's direction and control, which may be key. But you can't get very far with membership in the al-Qaeda context because, although this is often overlooked, al-Qaeda is not, for the most part, this hierarchical membership organization. It's probably best described as the would-be vanguard of a broad movement, what some people call the global jihad movement. It would be the vanguard of that movement. It's not coextensive with it. Yet our concern is that movement as a whole, at least insofar as it's expressed violently. We need to grapple with that, and that's got to be part of the reform dialogue. Thank you very much.
Thanks. I am, as a member of the audience of the first panel who had a lot of questions I wanted to ask, I'm going to try to keep this brief so we can stay on schedule and also get a chance to hear your questions. Also, I felt a little bit of trepidation when I heard David talk about the third way, having been branded by Stuart Taylor as a member of the moderate middle. I take it back. Good. Okay, I'm clear. I told Dan that this was, of the three panels, this is the one I really didn't want to be on, because I think it raises the hardest questions. And I will try to resist the temptation to answer Ken Anderson's provocative questions that he asked on the first panel and try to stick to the ones that we have to deal with, these really tough ones here. And I take the charge as thinking about as separate from a national security court for the purpose of prosecutions, what should our policy on and what mechanisms do we need for the purpose of detention solely? And as I heard it today and as I hear it frequently in this discussion, the discussion starts from a premise, and that premise is that we are going to come into possession of people who are too dangerous to release, but whom we can't try. And so then what? And we have a rich and interesting discussion about the mechanisms for solving that legal problem and what procedures we need to use and should we tinker with the machinery of the CSRT? Should we create a whole new system? And those are very, very interesting and important discussions. I happen to think that they're premature and that we're answering the wrong question, or at least we're tackling a question that should come after a broader policy question, and that's how I approach these issues from the perspective of the work that I do every day. I think the question ought to be, what is our overall strategy to defeat al-Qaeda, or at least to contain the risk of terrorism? and what should the role of detention be in that strategy? And until we answer that question, I think we are doomed to repeat some of the same mistakes that we've made in the past. You know, should detention play a central role in our counterterrorism strategy? If you haven't had a look at it yet, I would highly recommend that you read the Army's new counterinsurgency manual. It's actually it's available on Amazon, which I think is a first for an Army field manual. But I think that's a wonderful thing. And it sets out a strategy for the long term. You hear at every gathering that talks about these issues, you will always hear from everyone, and I don't think there's much dispute about it, that this is going to be a long struggle. And I think how the manual approaches this and how I think we ought to be thinking about it is how do we envision that ending, or at least winding down to a sufficient degree that we're not in a kind of on an emergency footing, and how do we get there? And for the purposes of this panel, what role does detention or should detention be in that strategy? Now, one of the provisions, sections in the counterinsurgency manual talks about how you defeat an enemy like this. And it is primarily not by killing or capturing. In fact, Donald Rumsfeld, when he was Secretary of Defense, once wondered, are we creating more terrorists than we're killing? And in a counterinsurgency kind of fight, that's the right question to ask. And you hear a lot about how do we win over the population from which the terrorists gain their recruits. Counterinsurgency operations have the capacity for easy recuperative power from the societies that in which they operate. And so part of our strategy, if we think about this seriously as a long-term struggle, is to delegitimize the enemy in the societies from which they seek their recuperative power. And so I think if we think about this, and this manual, by the way, I don't know if I mentioned, was drafted by General David Petraeus under his command. Before he left to take command in Iraq, he had command of the Army's Training and Doctrine Center at Fort Leavenworth, and in that command, he drafted, oversaw the drafting of this manual that takes into account the lessons learned from the current conflict. And in that manual, there is a specific warning about maintaining legitimacy, the United States in this struggle maintaining legitimacy, and the costs of engaging in illegitimate actions, undermining the rule of law, unlawful detention, torture, punishment without trial. These are all cited as illegitimate actions that ought to be avoided, that undermine our strategy in counterinsurgency. So I guess that's, for me, the context in which we ought to be thinking about these questions. And without that context, I think we can get very caught up in details about balancing liberty and security and how much will the Constitution allow and can we dial it down a little bit here and dial it up a little bit there. And we may find ourselves, I think, with a kind of new improved version of Guantanamo that does little to address the broader problems of that kind of a strategy. I guess for me, this was most striking to me when I compared the difference between the attitude of our system towards the shoe bomber. Do you remember Richard Reed? When he was sentenced to life plus 100 and something years, in a a courtroom, in a U.S. courtroom, by Judge Young, who, in a trial that was in most respects unassailable from the viewpoint of our own system and the rest of the world, he said this: "You are not a soldier in any war. You are a terrorist. To give you that reference, to call you a soldier, gives you far too much stature. You're no warrior. I know warriors. You're a terrorist, a species of criminal guilty of multiple attempted murders." And off you go. And we're never to be heard from again. You're going to jail 100 years, life plus 100 years. And then I read the CSRT transcript, such as we had it. It was obviously, some of it was classified, of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, where he was able in that system to address the uniformed Navy captain who was the overseer of that tribunal and said, "Yeah, you know, I did all these things." He confessed to, I don't know, 20 or 30 different horrible crimes, and said, "But, you know, soldier to soldier, these things happen in war, and I don't really want to kill civilians, but in a way, I'm just like George Washington. You know, a freedom fighter and all of that." And I find that highly unsatisfying, to say the least, a system that produces that kind of result, and no conviction yet, as compared to what we had in the criminal justice system. So I guess I challenge you to think about, what do we want the system to look like 5-10 years from now, and how do we get there? And this brings me back to the question about preventive detention. And I am concerned that if we rush to entrench a preventive detention system now in our law, that we will never get to what the next panel is going to talk about, which is how do we charge and try and convict terrorists so that we delegitimize them, as the counterinsurgency manual says we must in order to win this kind of a fight. I fear that we will never get there, because we'll create a system, as Gitmo really turned out to be, where we can dump people with very little process, and it will create a bureaucratic disincentive for us to end up where we want to be. The other thing I just want to lay on the table is that, again, taking the charge that this is going to be a long struggle, that we have to have a policy that's sustainable, and that it's not useful for us to charge out in another direction in a policy that is going to be mired in challenges and not viewed as legitimate by Americans or the rest of the world. That's counter to the strategy in the counterinsurgency manual, but it's also just impractical, and I think we ought to be learning from our mistakes. The last thing I just want to put on the table, and again, I don't have a solution for it, but I am increasingly concerned about the conflation of two debates that we seem to have. And one is, what do we do about Guantanamo? And a lot of talk about preventive detention comes in the context of, well, we have to close Guantanamo, and we have people there who we can't try, but who have told us that they'll, you know, try to kill us if we let them go. So we have to have something to do with those people. Answer: preventive detention of some kind. So there's that whole debate going on. And then there's the question, again, if we take it seriously, that this is going to be a long-term struggle, how do we deal with people who hopefully will come into our custody, who we want to interrogate and try? How do we deal with that going forward? I am concerned that if those two discussions are conflated, that the kinds of compromises that we're going to have to make to solve the problem of Guantanamo will set us off in the wrong direction for the system going forward. I think, you know, you hear embedded in the premise that there are people who we can't try. We have to be honest. You know, people say for a variety of reasons. Well, one of the reasons is because we have treated them in a way that produced so-called evidence that's not going to be admissible in any respectable court that bears the stamp made in America. So, you know, there is a that's what I mean when I say we're going to have to make compromises on both sides, I think, on the, to solve Guantanamo, that we will not be forced to make, hopefully, going forward. And so I think it's useful for us to try to separate those two things. And I don't know which one comes first, but I tend to think because the problem of Guantanamo as a symbol for the United States, as part, you know, if you look at this through the lens of the counterinsurgency manual, is so heavy that we need to deal with that as quickly as possible. Thanks.
Well, those were terrific and intriguing presentations, and certainly convinced me that the issues being addressed by this panel are not easy to solve. And I think what Bobby Chesney said about the relationship between the sort of process, what kind of courts, what kind of procedures should we have, and the substantive issues about our detention policy is a very important point, and that's what makes this thing so hard. I think the first thing I'll do, and we will give you all an opportunity to ask some questions, is to ask any of the panel members if they have something they're really dying to say in response to their colleagues. No hands go up. Okay, let's get some questions. Yeah, Marty. And then, I don't know. Do we need mics? I guess why don't you go to the mic? Yeah. I thought we were going to have someone with the mic, but go to the mic.
Thanks to all of you for a great panel and the first panel as well. In his column today, Ben laments that Judge Mukasey, who seemed to be the one person in the federal government who was sympathetic to this sort of movement toward a new legislative regime, seems disinclined to go anywhere near it. Why is that, right? This is not going to happen because the executive branch is not at all interested. The legislative branch isn't either. But the executive branch isn't at all either, and they're not going to pick up Bobby and Jack's suggestions, even if those are the most sort of pro-government of those of you on the panel, because this, from the executive branch's perspective, this regime is not principally about war or crime. It's not about convicting people or about incapacitating soldiers or combatants. It's about gathering intelligence. They're not going to let anyone have a lawyer. That defeats the whole purpose. They're not going to have short-term detention because, from their perspective, they need these long-term, many-month interrogations of Jose Padilla sort of situation. He was detained. He was in the criminal justice system. Why was he transferred to this special other system? So that his will could be broken over many months so that he would provide intelligence to stop the next attack. So from the executive's position, and I have to assume this will be the case maybe in the next administration as well, they talk a lot about the crime and the war paradigms and analogies, but it's really intelligence gathering that's driving their detention policies. And we don't have any model in the law or in history for an intelligence-based, long-term, it's not preventive detention, it's squeezing information out of people detention regime. That's why Ken's question at the end of the last panel, right, it's not about these folks, what we really care about is we want to round up as many people as possible because one of them might have some information about the next devastating attack. And we don't have any way of talking about that, and I'm afraid of what a regime along those lines would possibly look like, but it wouldn't be anything like Matt's or Bobby's, and it certainly wouldn't be the traditional crime and war regimes that David describes. So
well,
I'm curious. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to get some comments on this and just throw out as a footnote to Marty's comment and question, what about short-term preventive detention like in the UK, which I take it is basically for the purpose of interrogation? Lisa, you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, does this work okay? One reason may be why there's not that much enthusiasm on the part of the executive branch is that they don't think they would get that from the Congress. I mean, you know, think back, you know, when Attorney General Ashcroft brought over the first draft of the Patriot Act on September 19th to the Republican-controlled House, It had a provision in it that would have permitted, you know, long-term preventive detention on the say-so of the Attorney General. And, you know, Jim Sensenbrenner said, over my dead body, that's too extreme. You know, eight days after 9/11. And what they ended up getting in section, I think it was 214 of the Patriot Act, was a seven-day, you know, without charge or trial detention system that had safeguards in it. You had to report to Congress how you were using it, what happened, you had to charge. And there was a reporting requirement, a six-month reporting requirement. So in October, I went into the Justice Department and met with some people in the deputy's office and said, I hope you're keeping the records, and how are you going to respond and submit the reports? And, you know, they thought I was, they found me amusing. They said, we're not going to use that provision. We have lots of other ways to detain people without charge or trial, and we're not going to use that. You know, they fought for it, but once there were safeguards in it, they said, well, we're going to use our executive power to do that, and we don't need any stinking statute. So I think that may be one of the reasons why you're not going to see so much of a legislative battle over this.
Dave, I'm sure David wants to talk about this.
A couple things. One is there are ways of gathering intelligence. There are ways of gathering intelligence, right? One way of gathering intelligence is keeping track of suspicious people and getting FISA taps and seeing who they're talking to and what they're talking about and building a case and then arresting, right? And that's the way Scotland Yard does it for the most part. Everybody's interested in intelligence. It's not like, you know, we're the only people who are interested in intelligence. Everybody's interested in intelligence, but it's how you gather it.
If, by contrast,
go out and pick up, you know, 5,000 people in the United States in 2 years who have nothing to do with terrorism because they're Arab or Muslim, right, and they're locked up, well, then now you can't use the traditional methods of gathering intelligence because you've locked up people, you can't track them. They're, you know, if there were any people who were dangerous, they're on notice now, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the only intelligence tactic you have at that point is to interrogate them, and then you're pressed to use shortcuts that lead to the very problems that Elisa was talking about, and that you can't try the people who you ultimately find out. So I think the real the problem here is doing the detention first and then trying to gather intelligence rather than doing it the other way around, which I think is a much more effective way, does not create the problems that you can't try people, actually makes it much more likely that you'll get successful convictions. I'll also say that I don't think it's just about intelligence. I don't think it's fair to say it's just about intelligence because, of course, the people at Guantanamo at this point have no intelligence value, right? No intelligence value, but some of them we still want to hold because not because we think we're going to get more out of them after 6 years of being in captivity about current threats, but because we're worried that they're fighting for the enemy against us, which I think is a legitimate, under the laws of war, is a legitimate concern and legitimately gives rise to the interest in detention. So I think you have to separate out the war context and the other context, but the problem here is detaining first and then asking questions rather than the other way around.
Let me just jump in real quick and say that I agree, especially with the way David just framed it, that I think you're absolutely right in probably we all should have been mentioned along the way, which is that the intelligence piece and the interrogation piece is a critical part of the analysis. And when you talk about detention policy, either descriptively or normatively, and you don't talk about interrogation policy, then you're missing what is often driving the train. And so it's a part of the conversation that we haven't really built into our discussion, but we should. The this conference is that, you know, we're laying some framework out there. We're considering what might happen. Granted that at the old executive office, there are many people who are not going to read these papers or pay attention to these ideas. But I think even within the administration, there are some folks who are thinking that from a security perspective, status quo is unsustainable. That from a security perspective, some reform would be needed. And for those who are coming out of the individual rights perspective, I'd say there's a risk here of letting, from their perspective, which is a perspective I often share, letting the best be the enemy of the good and holding out for what would be an ideal solution often could, in this context, might prevent some reforms that would be a substantial improvement over the status quo.
Matt, do you have anything you want to add?
That covered it. I agree largely with what Bobby said. I would just add, you know, to a point that David made, I think they overstated to say that the individuals at Guantanamo have zero intelligence value. There may actually be intelligence value in releasing them, right? We may have more to gain from an intelligence perspective from releasing them and watching where they go and seeing who they talk to than keeping them there. And one role that sort of legal reform and innovation can play here is in perhaps constraining some misguided decision making on the executive's part as to sort of how it wants to allocate its resources between the sort of the preventive detention mission and the sort of intelligence collection mission, right? Because sometimes they go hand in hand, as Marty said, right? You detain somebody, you incapacitate them, and it also gives you an opportunity to question that person. Sometimes those two missions or objectives, the sort of the incapacitation mission and the intelligence mission, are actually in some tension and trade-off, right? You incapacitate somebody, you take them out of circulation, you disrupt the plot, and that's useful, but it also ends any intelligence collection that you might have gained from watching who that person talks to. And those are difficult trade-offs. And I think, as David said, I think we have something to learn from the British who actually, I think, often make some smart choices in that regard.
But don't the British also have at least short-term preventive detention largely for interrogation purposes?
Very, very short-term.
Like 14 days, by our standards. That's right.
Yeah. That's one of the things that they're sort of debating now.
Whether to extend that.
But it's measured in sort of single-digit days.
Right. But the length of the preventive detention for interrogation purposes isn't nearly so interesting as what is it they're going to be allowed to do to that person for however many number of days they've got them.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing about the British situation is that once they're charged, they can't be questioned. So that puts tremendous pressure on questioning them before they're charged. Whereas in our system, you can charge them and then you can continue to question them.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Yeah. My name's Ben Davis, University of Toledo Law School. My question is along this line. There is a first predicate to everything that owns, is that this is going to be a long struggle. And I ask, why does that predicate have to be there? What is the basis that all of us think it's a long struggle? I mean, in my childhood, we certainly thought about communism was going to last forever. And I would imagine, why do we go with that predicate? In addition, I'd ask, what do we mean by struggle? I mean, are we talking of the nature of level of something, a World War II, which creates certain kinds of situations and choices that we'd have to make? Or are we talking of something that's much more of a low-level type of struggle, which makes a whole series of other issues? The concern I have is that by speaking of this as a long-term struggle, it encourages all of us to acquiesce in giving up things, because we assume it has to be. Obviously, it's a struggle, but of what nature and of what dimension? And going along with that, the question I have is, all the stuff is not new. It goes back to the Romans dealing with this type of issue, if you read Grotius, and when the world was divided into law and peace. And it seems like hybrids here are really talking about panic and then improvisation, which is what we've had for 6 or 7 years. And this is a further improvisation with the Security Court. The final thing I think is the most fundamental question I ask you, what do you do with governmental lawlessness? In other words, where the government's given these authorities and they act outside the law. And how do we prosecute the high-level civilians and military general levels, which we don't prosecute, for those violations, including the torture part or any other part? Because we don't do that. We haven't done it for 100 years. I looked it up. And if we can't deal with that part where people act crazy, then how can we deal with train a created system where they can act even crazier?
Yeah, I'd like a volunteer to answer at least the first two questions. I think the third question, which is an important one, which is how do we deal with government officials who exceed the law, whether it's a torture law or anything else, is I think perhaps beyond the scope of this panel. Although
different kind of national security court.
yes, Alicia.
Since I was premising my remarks on this idea of a long struggle, as my assumption going forward. Maybe I should take a crack at this one. And I think, you know, if you go by how long communism lasted, I guess that I would consider that a pretty long, struggle. But one of the points that Ken Anderson and I make in this piece that I think is in your packets, where we look at this, you know, is it law? Is it war? Is it criminal justice? Is it war? What's the right paradigm? Is that, and we conclude really that, you know, it can be both, even simultaneously, that we need to get away from this bifurcation. And I think it's conceivable that as part of our counterterrorism operations, whatever you want to call it, our, you know, engagement with Al-Qaeda, that there may be another actual war involved in that. I mean, I hope not, but it's not inconceivable, and I think, you know, the war in Afghanistan was a part of that. That doesn't mean we have to treat the whole thing like a war and then try to squeeze everything into the laws of war, thereby turning them into a pretzel and undermining the standards that we, our own people, are going to rely on in the next war. But I think we just have to get out of that, you know, that either-or dichotomy and think about, and is there, I mean, one of the questions we reach at the end of our piece is, you know, what's the place in between, and how do we get rules for that part of it? I think on the, you know, on the question, I do think this question about accountability is relevant to what we're talking about here, because it goes to the checks and balances that you put in a system. I mean, the more you have a system of secret detention or, you know, interrogation rules that aren't public, a detention system that facilitates those kinds of things, then it's an invitation to abuse. And the United States is not unique in that respect. All governments go that path when given. That's why our system is better than most, because we insist on those kinds of checks and balances.
Anyone else want to add anything on this? Okay. Any other questions? I'd like to ask one. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes. Please come to the mic.
Yes, sir. Professor Cole mentioned his concern that by creating a specialized national security court with different procedures, that we could get in the habit of weakening our own traditions and the safeguards that we have. Others would argue that by restricting those procedures to a specialized court, that you would preserve intact the safeguards in criminal law generally. And I wondered if anyone wanted to respond to that balance.
I'll jump in on that, because I think I'm sort of in that latter camp of saying that without, if you remove C-certs, or even if you leave them in place, there's already tremendous distorting pressure within the criminal justice system to take, let's say, envelope-pushing positions on just how broad substantive criminal law is. It concerns me. And I think one of the things that can be said in favor of some sort of standalone system is, A, you can come up with something better than the C-certs, almost certainly, and B, to a certain extent, you may relieve some of that distorting pressure from the criminal justice system. But having said that, let me attack myself by saying that that all sounds great on a panel, but how exactly do you draw the lines? You know, would I then say that even though we have been prosecuting the occasional Al-Qaeda suspect within the United States in the ordinary Article III courts, should we stop doing that then and bring them all into the national security court system? That doesn't sound very appealing either. So I want to be frank in acknowledging that one of the hardest questions, I think you're going to hear more about this in the next panel, is deciding who goes into which system, whichever combination of systems you have. How do you channel it? Who's the decision maker? What are the criteria? And that's setting aside what process is used in each of the systems and what substantive charges or detention criteria are used. So maybe we've introduced or highlighted a further level of complexity that just makes this sound even harder.
I guess I'd say, you know, we've already seen remarkable envelope pushing. In fact, I don't know many prosecutors who aren't envelope pushers in general. And you've certainly seen that since 9/11, notwithstanding the fact that there is an existing non-criminal
military detention model that we have used and we've used successfully to detain thousands of people around the world. So I don't think you're going to take that pressure off of the criminal justice system by creating something, some hybrid in the middle. I think you're going to make it easier to make the kind of incremental arguments that undermine protections within the criminal process. And so, you know, and just as an example, the story that I'm sure many people are familiar with, but in the UK, the story of the privilege against self-incrimination, which they had. We got it from them. And during the Troubles in Northern Ireland, they decided that, you know, investigating terrorism was really, particularly in Northern Ireland, was a real problem because people weren't talking. So let's just do away with the privilege against self-incrimination for terrorism cases in Northern Ireland. And we're limited to terrorism cases in Northern Ireland because we don't want to, you know, we recognize its value elsewhere, but we want to limit there. And then a few years later, they realize, well, actually, terrorism is not limited to Northern Ireland. It affects all of the UK. So let's expand it and let's get rid of the privilege against self-incrimination with respect to terrorism cases in the UK generally. And that was enacted. And then, you know, a few years later, people started saying, well, you know, if we can get rid of the privilege against self-incrimination because it interferes with investigating terrorism, you know, shouldn't we all? It also interferes with investigating mass murders. And so sure enough, eventually there was no, and there is today, no privilege against self-incrimination in any criminal case. So I don't think creating a sort of a special category of terrorism and then treating it differently is a way to take the pressure off of the criminal justice. And the only thing I'd add to that is what Judge Brinkema said at lunchtime, which is that you know, the definition of terrorism is so difficult. And it's so manipulable, and it's so potentially expansive that it's not limiting, not a limiting principle, even on its own terms.
Can I just respond real quickly?
Yeah.
Of course, we're talking here not so much about taking the criminal justice status quo and then carving out a new, more permissive system. It's at least as plausible to look at it as taking the CSER military detention status quo and improving that and making it harder to do some of these things in that system. And so,
I'm all in favor of reforming the CSIRT system, but keeping it within the law of war model. What I find problematic is the Goldsmith Kochall proposal, which takes it out of the war model and says we're now going to have longstanding preventive detention of suspected terrorists without any connection to a military conflict. Right. I think that's
one of the ways you try to address that and cabin that is to make sure that the criteria for being shunted into whatever national security court system or CSIRT system, whatever it is, has some linkage to some sort of specific legislatively enacted description of who it is that might be subject to this, and the standard can't be terrorism for the reasons you said. That's just too broad.
Okay, next question.
My question is kind of directed towards Professor Cole's analysis, really, the dichotomy, essentially a trade-off between imminent threat, which we will address with military force, and justice, which is where we start applying to our society. And my problem is that with the war on terror, the way it is today, is that we see less of training camps in Afghanistan, that we have real targets to attack, like with military force. So you're going to necessarily be pushing the war on terror into the justice system. And I think that is going to be problematic if you start thinking of justice system less as an abstract concept, but also as a way for society to make a trade-off between a certain level of acceptable types of crimes that we're willing to live with and also try to prevent excessive policing of our society, so that where the level of crime is something that we find intolerable, that it becomes something where massive attacks on capable of destroying entire communities, that we're willing to push it out of the trial system, because we're no longer the balance does not work out in such a fashion. And that's.
Well, I guess I'm not 100% sure what the focus of the question is.
Sure. It means where the trade-off it changes, where it becomes the level of violence as threatened from massive, you know, terrorism, yeah, cyber-terrorism, things like that, where the threat to the community is so great and that it outweighs any kind of advantage we gain from preventing excessive policing of our society. That doesn't that require something in between military force, which we really can't use in a lot of these circumstances?
I don't know. You know, I mean, on the one hand, terrorism, as it's not as it's imagined in you know novels, but as it's actually played out in the real world today,
is a problem that that countries have dealt with for a very long time, principally through a criminal justice model, and I think can be. An existential threat, as Ben, I think Ben termed it earlier, is something that the communities respond to militarily and should respond to militarily. And if you see if there's an existential threat that is imminent, you have the right to respond to it militarily. The concept of an existential threat that's not imminent, to me, is that's when you get into very, very dangerous waters. Remember, the reason we went to war in Iraq is because of an existential threat that was not imminent. It seems to me that's a very, very dangerous predicate upon which to authorize the state to use coercive means of any kind. So I think you gather intelligence, you respond to routine terrorism, which is what most terrorism is, through the criminal process, and when you are attacked in the way we were on 9/11, or you face an imminent attack like that, you can and should respond militarily.
Okay, I think we're going to have to wind up because obviously we're running late. I might attempt a one-minute summary if Vladek will allow me, and that is, it seems to me that we have some consensus from this morning's panel and this panel that, at least with respect to the battlefield detainees, that we might call them, that the law of war system justifying detention to keep the guy from going back to the battlefield works pretty well, and you don't have to worry so much about the due process considerations, and particularly if, as Judge Wald suggested this morning, you go back to making on the battlefield decisions with respect to these people as we traditionally do in wars. But the big question there, which there's no good answer to, is the indefinite nature of the detention. And I was encouraged this morning to hear from John Bellinger that the administration is beginning to realize that you cannot sustain indefinite detention and that they've got to either try or release these people eventually and maybe in the near future. But I think the problem of the detainees, the higher level detainees who were originally in the CIA camps or the ones that we are capturing now in various places around the world, that's where the more difficult questions come up. I think there is a consensus that we ought to at least improve the CSRT process, have more due process, maybe lawyers, more effort to see and contest evidence on the part of the detainees. Where I don't think we have a consensus is whether we ought to replace the military decision makers by real civilian judges. And that's an issue that continues to be controversial. Okay, let's take a 10-minute break. And the third and last panel will start at 3 o'clock promptly.